Hi, this is Paul Puckett. Welcome to Getting There, the money show that focuses on your life. You know, I try to do only about 10, 15, 20% of the show on money topics because, quite frankly, there are much more interesting things in life to talk about. I incorporate music into the show to highlight points and also to give your mind a break because, quite frankly, money is, well, boring unless you were actually using it. Speaking of which, why don't we start out the show with a little bit of a definition on what your investment portfolio, your bank account, your CDs, any money you have that you're not spending, what is that from a common sense standpoint? It's deferred spending. It's deferred spending. Okay, deferred means you're not doing it now, you're going to do it later. Obviously, know what spending is. We're really good at that. So deferred spending means, okay, I'm making, pick a number, $3,000 a month. I pay $1,000 for rent. I have another $1,000 in food, clothing, miscellaneous expenses, gasoline, car payment, whatever. Hopefully, you don't have another $2,000 in payments. At any rate, first thing you should know, those of you who are already working know this, if you're making $36,000 a year, that's $3,000 a month. If you're paid twice a month, that's $1,500 a month. But is that what you get in your paycheck? The answer is no. One of the first things that screws us up from a savings standpoint and an investing standpoint is when we get our first job, we're so happy. If it's $24,000 a year, we're going to get $2,000 a month. Later, we find out we're really only going to get about $1,500, depending on where you live. Federal taxes, Social Security, FICA, state income taxes if you have them, city income taxes if you live in New York. All these things are withheld from your pay before you actually get the money. So you're not really making $24,000 or $36,000 or whatever the number is. You're making something less than that when it comes to what you actually receive. And then, of course, you can elect and should to contribute to a 401k or retirement plan and to save some of the money you make to defer to later, so that you have the ability to do what you want later in life. So a very basic example. Let's talk a little bit about something that everybody gets confused. Totally different subject here. It's the unemployment rate. We hear it argued about, given that it's an election year. And even when it's not an election year, you hear the parties go back and forth on who's better for employment and all this type of stuff. And I'm not taking a political position here before you head for the exits. This year, as in most years, I have my opinions politically, but I don't see any need to pressure you with those. We all have our opinions. What I like is knowing that we all know what's being discussed so we can make our own rational decisions. The unemployment rate, how is that calculated and what does it mean and when did they start doing it? Okay, the Department of Labor, back in 1940, started calculating unemployment. And if you were to look at a chart of unemployment, it's actually looks similar to a heartbeat. It goes up, it goes down, it flips all around. You know, we've seen a low back in, oh, I guess 1953 of about 3% and a high of about 10 or 11% in the early 1980s when they created the Misery Index. It's fallen over the past few years, since about 2010, after rocketing up in 2008, 2009, and topping out in 2010 near 10%. But what does that number mean, and is it a reliable number, and how is it taken? Okay, basically, there's three types of people, two of whom are measured in the labor rate. The three types of people are people who are working. Those would be the employed. People who are not working but are looking for a job and trying to find work. Those would be the unemployed. And people that are just not in the labor force. They're not factored into the number at all. And that's why sometimes you hear two numbers. Now, the survey is taken of these three types of people. And the first thing you should know is it's a big survey, over 100,000 people. Each month are surveyed by the Department of Labor Bureau of Statistics. But the survey is not comprehensive. It doesn't cover all eligible workers in the United States. It still is a survey, even though it's really, really big. If you've noticed, a lot of studies are, you know, we talked to 40 people. A big study is 1,000. Well, this is 100,000. So let's look at those three categories a little bit. And I'm talking about this because in a minute we're going to be talking, or towards the end of the show, we're going to be talking about when you're working, the problems that come up from a financial standpoint that can get in the way of you having an enjoyable, happy life. Money can get in the way. That's one of the reasons we're here on this show, getting there. We're all getting there. And ideally, we get into a situation where money is what it should be, simply a tool. But let's talk a little bit more about the labor rate. So employed is simple. They get a phone call from the Bureau of Statistics, Department of Labor, and they say, are you working? Yes, I am. Okay, that's an employed person. We get a little hazy on not working. The issue is someone who is unemployed, by the definition since 1940, with just a few minor changes, is someone who wants to be working but can't find a job or isn't employable or for whatever reason they don't have one right now. They're still trying to get one. So they might be on unemployment insurance. They might have already been on unemployment insurance and it's expired, but they're still looking for a job. They're considered unemployed. Well, the third number, which is not in the survey as a percentage, is people who are not in the labor force. Now, before you think it's a conspiracy, this makes perfect sense, particularly if you look back to 1940 when women were not as heavy in the workforce as they are now. World War II, suddenly we find out women can work. Ladies, if you're listening, that was a semi-facetious remark. Of course you can. You've been working harder than men probably since the beginning of time. In your own way, doing many, many things that we either don't want to do, can't do, or are too lazy to do. So women entered the workforce, but before they did, they were housewives. Well, housewives aren't looking for a job. They're not working. They're not planning on getting a job. We still have housewives today and house husbands too. Those people are neither employed or unemployed. What about retired people? Well, they're not looking for a job. And they're not working, they're also not in that percentage number. So when you hear, for instance, unemployment is 5.5%, that's 5.5% of the people who have a job and the people who don't want have one but want one. Everybody else is not in that percentage number. So sometimes you'll hear people say the real unemployment number is much higher. What they're trying to do is exclude the people who do not have a job, never will, because they've chosen not to, housewives, or retired. Ladies, again, if I get myself in trouble by saying housewife multiple times, there are males who stay at home and take care of the kids and do all those things too these days. But if you're not looking for a job, you're not in the survey. It's the first question they ask after someone says they're not working and not looking. They say, do you currently want a job, either full or part-time? If the answer is no, they're out of the survey. So I share that just to say, if you were job hunting, whatever your age is, and you're thinking, gee, 95% of Americans are working and I'm not, there's something wrong with me. Well, never hurts to have an introspective look and investigate things you can do to make yourself more employable, but it's not 95% who are working. It's much smaller than that, because it's not including a significant portion of the population, children, retirees, and anyone who is staying at home because they wish to and have the ability to. So, you know, I think what many of you may be thinking is, give me a job, give me security, and give me a chance to survive. And we move to our first song of the day, Styx, Blue Collar Man. And that was Styx live in concert with a song released in 1978, Blue Collar Man, Give Me a Job, Give Me Security, Give Me a Chance to Survive. We think it's the worst of times now, but you know, it really isn't. People were having trouble finding jobs in the 70s too, and in the 80s, and to a certain degree in the 90s. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse, but there's never been a time where somebody is not struggling to make it. It's just the way the universe is designed. So if you are one of those people, focus on what you can do to improve your chances and recognize that even if you hear unemployment is 5% and think, well, that means 95% are working. No, actually it doesn't. It means of the people who either have a job or want a job and are looking for a job, 95% are working. Everybody else is not included. Okay, so we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, let's talk a little bit about life insurance. Hi, this is Paul Puckett. As you may know, I love coffee. My friends would tell you I don't love coffee. It's an obsession, and not just any coffee. Espresso. If you're in the Bradenton area, one of the jewels of Bradenton is Old Main Street, and you'll find a coffee shop, B-Town Coffee, with a great alley and awnings and fans to keep you cool in the summer and in the shade, free Wi-Fi, and quite frankly, the best hot dog in town. Stop by. You'll enjoy B-Town Coffee. It occurs to me as I hear myself promoting B-Town Coffee, which is a courtesy because I really love B-Town Coffee and highly recommend it if you're in the Bradenton area. It occurs to me that since I moved a little farther east, I haven't been to B-Town Coffee in at least 2 weeks, which I just can't tell you how soon I will be fixing that problem. Okay, seatbelts. Tables and chairs in their upright and locked position. Get your seatbelts and your crash helmets. We're going to talk a little bit about life insurance. Oh, no. Life insurance was my first financial services job when I graduated with music degrees and decided that wasn't what I wanted to do. And it's a fascinating area because it's one of the few things that you can do during your life directly for someone else that doesn't necessarily benefit you. But the industry has made it a bit confusing. In the old days when I started, there were really three types of life insurance: term, whole life, and something called universal. Term insurance is pretty simple. It's basically the same thing you have on your car or your home. You buy the insurance for a term. So 1 year, annually renewable term, 5 year, 10 year, 20 year, 30 year. Some companies even go farther, depending on how young you are, when you buy the policy. Then there's whole life. Whole life sometimes is defined as like term insurance, except it's permanent insurance with an investment account. But that is not what whole life is. It does have cash value, but it is not an investment account. With whole life, what you do is you pay an insurance company a higher premium than you would for term, with the knowledge that as long as you pay that premium, you will have a death benefit regardless of when you die. It's not really an investment account, though. It's not tied to the markets. It's not anything you can control. It's actually the insurance company's interest-bearing account inside the policy. And by the terms of whatever contract, that's another word for life insurance policy, the terms of the contract define what interest rate you'll earn. It can't go below a certain minimum, but it can be higher if the insurance company chooses to pay a higher amount. Well, the problem with whole life insurance is once you sign that application and the delivery receipt that you've received the contract, there's no flexibility. Well, very little. You have a premium you will pay. Now, some policies, to make it complicated, have what's called a participation rate, and those insurance policies are offered by mutual companies as opposed to stock companies. What that simply means is a mutual company is owned by policyholders, whereas a stock company obviously is owned by stockholders. Well, stocks often pay a dividend, particularly financial services stock, but some companies are not publicly held in the stock market. They're publicly held by their shareholders, which means they're not really publicly held. And they have participation dividends that may eventually pay the premium, but you don't always know that. The dividends are not guaranteed. So Universal was created to offer flexibility. Universal insurance functions like term. Every year, the internal mortality cost, that's the cost to cover the insurance, goes up. But you have an account in the policy that allows you to earn interest. And so over the years, what you hope to do is build up a large enough cash value that your existing premium doesn't change when you get older. But the internal costs skyrocket when you hit 80, 85, 90. And so you have to make sure there is sufficient cash value there. The other big impact, which we saw in the early 90s and early part of this century, is insurance agents at the time were seeing interest rates of 12 to 14%, and that's what they projected the policies to do. Well, take a look. Interest rates have plummeted. Policies didn't do 12%. So needless to say, their performance suffered. Universal Life has a couple of different variants, and that's what the purpose of that background I just gave you was just so we can have a conversation about two specific types. Very briefly, on variable life insurance does allow you to have an investment account, a real investment account. Now, you're limited to what the insurance company allows you to select from various sub-accounts. Now, there's a distinction. Excuse me, even if they have the same name as a mutual fund, they're not mutual funds. The expenses are different, typically higher, and they're housed inside of this insurance policy wrapper. Variable life insurance was the rage for a while because the growth of that policy is not taxed. It's deferred. If you die, when you die, the death benefit goes tax-free, assuming you set up the policy properly, to your heirs. I don't like variable life because it has the same disadvantages that universal life has in that the internal costs go sky high the older you get. The other issue with variable life is the expenses of the policy itself are not low. There's better ways to invest. All right, a whole new type of universal life came out a number of years ago, and they also have annuities that have this same word, and this is what I want to talk to you about today. Indexed, that word, indexed universal life, indexed annuities, you wonder, well, what do you mean indexed? Okay. On a regular insurance policy, universal or whole life, the interest rate is stated by the insurance company. It's declared by the insurance company. It's not driven by, well, it may be driven internally by other factors, but from your standpoint as a policyholder, the insurance company says we're paying 4% on the cash value of your policy, whatever the number is. If you're getting 4 these days, congratulations. Well, with indexed universal life, you don't actually know what your return is going to be. You know it will not be negative other than the mortality expenses and administrative expenses that come out of the policy. But you know the investment return won't be negative because you're really not invested. What you have is an interest account, and the interest rate is based on an index like the S&P 500. Quite frankly, originally, it was just the S&P 500 with some important differences. The S&P 500 you see on the news every night does not have the dividends from all those companies included. It's called a price return index, and the insurance policies use the price return index. So let's say they say, we're going to give you a cap of 12%, meaning you cannot make over 12, and a participation rate of 50%, and the market does 18 that year. A brief side note, when I say 18, you're probably thinking the market never does 18. No, the market never does its average. It's always way above or way below. It sometimes is close. But generally speaking, market averages, don't count on that every year. That's a long-term average annual rate of return that you shouldn't count on at all. You should anticipate that over time the market will grow. But don't look at a projection and assume 20 years from now the projection will happen. I've never seen it. It's been higher or it's been lower. At any rate, indexed means market does 18, you have a 50% participation rate. 50% of 18 is 9. 9 is below the cap of 12, so your policy gets a 9% return. Awesome, right? These policies actually can be a very good insurance alternative for people who are looking for permanent insurance, but there's a key, a very important key, to indexed universal life. These policies need, desperately, to be overfunded in the early years or to be purchased at a young age. Why? Same issue as all universal life policies. The internal costs, which, by the way, you can't see, and as an agent, I can't really see them either. The internal costs go up just like term insurance does. It's much cheaper to buy insurance at 20 than 60. You'd be surprised. There's not that much difference between 20 and 30, a bigger difference between 30 and 40. And starting around 65, it really starts to go up. Well, any universal life contract, these internal expenses go up. That means you better have enough cash value to carry the expenses long enough for the policy to still be in force when you pass away without you having to put in extra money. So why am I talking about indexed universal life? There are so many seminars and books today on tax-free retirement. You can have a tax-free retirement. Are these seminars and books accurate? Well, sort of. You invest in an indexed universal life policy and borrow against that policy. That's a non-taxable event. The only issue is, what happens if you take out too much and it lapses? Well, the insurance companies thought of that. So they created something that drops the death benefit generally down to $10,000 to $25,000, so that the policy doesn't lapse and turn all those things you borrowed into a taxable event. Still, the expenses of these policies internally is not cheap. So if you are considering, or you go to a seminar and start to consider, indexed universal life, it can be a very good product, ideally purchased during your working years, 25, 30, up to 55, maybe 60. The issue being, the later you wait to buy that type of policy, and I'm not saying that to urge you to run get one. I think there's different ways to skin the cat. A good insurance agent's going to run not just indexed universal life, but he's also going to run whole life. And look at, well, what do we know we're going to get? What do we know our cost is going to be? What's the risk if we do not? But indexed universal life can be a viable alternative. I would urge you, should you attend a seminar where someone says, hey, you can have a tax-free retirement. Yeah, maybe, but you need to look real closely at how those things work. They are more complicated than they appear to be, but they're not a bad product, particularly when purchased early. If you're over 60, I would highly encourage you to look for a different product, unless you have a huge amount to transfer from another cash value policy. And even then, think long and hard. Work with a knowledgeable agent, preferably one who is also, not preferably, in my opinion, work with one who is also securities licensed, because the underlying interest rate, the calculation that drives the interest rate, is based on the stock market. All right, so you may now take off your seatbelts, ease your table back into its position, and recline your chair. We're done with the complicated life insurance conversation. It's important, though, because there's so many. One of the points I made when I was interviewed, a friend of mine is retired, turning 70, I believe, shortly, and he made the comment that back in the day, this is not that long ago, 20 years ago, there were a lot of insurance agents, but the internet has taken over to a certain degree, and there are less life insurance agents out there. In addition, those life insurance agents are less knowledgeable than those from 20 years ago. So be careful when you get advice from a life insurance agent. Ask questions. Make sure you understand the answers. Make sure they know exactly what they're doing and have experience in whatever, whether it's estate planning or whatever area you're talking with them about, to make sure that you have better odds of getting the right policy. All right. Let's take another brief break, this one with another song, because what you may have felt or may feel when you go to an insurance seminar or somebody starts talking to you about tax-free retirement or whatever is you may feel like they're playing a head game. Another song from the 70s, Foreigner, Head Games. I don't want to keep playing these head games. We try and find the answer, but it's nowhere in sight. Head games. And that was Foreigner. I'm enjoying the music a little more this week. I did a millennial show last week, and the music, although I have to admit, it's pretty good music. Still, I tend to lean towards blues, rock and roll, and something that has a nice electric guitar, preferably loud. Okay, Market Watch had an interesting article this week by Maria Lamagna. I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that name right, because Lamagna, I'm betting, is either Italian, possibly Hispanic, but with the first name Maria, I guess it could go either way. She's a reporter with Market Watch, and she wrote an article regarding, I think, seven things that people in a survey, 5,700 people in a survey released Wednesday by the Federal Reserve, responded to some questions, and their answers were interesting. They're doing better, many of them, than in recent years, but they still face tough choices. And this is one of her lines she wrote, leading them to make some bad financial moves, from taking on risky loans to undersaving for retirement to trying to make up for that, I'm adding, by investing in things that may be too risky, or for some of you, not risky enough. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the items in this survey, and this will go back to why I was talking about the labor participation rate, unemployment rate, and how it's calculated. Okay, according to this survey by the Federal Reserve, generally speaking, this won't come as a surprise, Americans have very little in emergency savings. You know, your emergency fund, that thing you meant to do, but didn't. Well, let's go back to what we were talking about earlier. So you've got a salary, right? And you're making, you think, whatever that salary amount is. But you really aren't. Withholding and everything else means you're making a different number. I would urge you, I don't care how long you've been working, get out the checkbook, take the amount you take home, net of anything you're contributing, or include anything you're contributing to retirement plans. But look at what's withheld. Take the net number, the number you actually receive, multiply it times the number of times you're paid for a year. If you're paid weekly, 52. If you're paid twice a month, 24. If you're paid, I'm at 26. If you're paid every other week, however, just multiply it times the same number. If you're paid monthly, I don't know how many people paid monthly, then multiply it times 12. That's what you're actually making. The most important thing you can do early on, preferably, unless you're making up for lost time, which some people are, and that's okay. Just means you really got to focus on it, is you got to build up emergency savings, an emergency fund. Now, people differ on how much that should be. Some say 3 months of pay. So if you're making $24,000 a year, you discover that's actually more like $18,000 a year, then you would need $1,500 times three, $4,500 in your emergency fund. That's not enough. Sorry. That's not enough. Your emergency fund, in my opinion, should be a minimum of whatever you know it would cost you to live for a minimum of 6 months if you lost your job. Now, you get unemployment insurance, but you'll still have other expenses. You also may need to replace your car periodically. We'll talk sometime about cars. That may actually be here in the article. You might want to know, we mentioned The Millionaire Mind, The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley and the research he did on American millionaires, almost none of whom buy new cars. Think about that for a minute. Avoid the depreciation. I always buy used. Highly recommend it. It's just harder to find exactly what you want. But then again, that can be fun. 18% of those surveyed said either they or family members living with them had some type of financial hardship in the last year. They mentioned a health emergency, losing a job, having their work hours or their pay reduced, or getting a divorce. Now, we've mentioned this before. Health issues and divorce are financial killers. You may not be able to control either one of those, but be aware they have a huge impact on your financial statement. 46%, you may want to put the tables and seatbacks back in their upright and locked position, said they could not cover an emergency expense without selling something or borrowing money for any amount over $400. $400. So one of the things we need to focus on after we get past the head games of the financial service industry is, you know, hey, you need to build up your emergency fund. I'll be putting a link to this MarketWatch article on my webpage, gettingthere.life, and I'm doing these out of order. I may not do all of them. I'm doing the ones I think are important. Relating to not having anything in emergency savings or very little, a significant, large actually, number of adults don't have any retirement savings. About 31% have no pension as part of their job. That's pretty much the norm these days. But they also have no retirement savings. They're basically spending everything they earn, meaning no deferred spending, also known as savings and investments. It varied by age. So the majority who had no retirement savings or pensions shouldn't surprise you. Age 18 to 29, they're just getting their start. Although I have to tell you all that are in the 18 to 29 age group, the sooner you can start, the more time your money has to grow. And it's the one huge advantage you have over everybody else. It's an advantage we used to have, those with, like me with gray hair. 75% of non-retired people 45 and older had a little bit, but not significant. The balances are really amazingly low. 14% of adults who are not retired but are working 60 years of age and older had no retirement savings at all. Now, that could have been caused by a health issue, could have been caused by a divorce. There's all sorts of reasons that might have happened, but it also could have been because they just didn't contribute to a retirement plan. So retirement savings have become very, very important. Why? Well, because we're not getting the pension anymore. Sometimes it's because the employer doesn't offer it. But interesting survey, the large percentage. Now, this one, I have to tell you, it's not funny, but being in the industry, I can tell you with a high level of confidence that of the smaller percentage who actually have retirement savings and investments and an emergency fund, and they're sitting right where they want to be, well, here's the deal. They're not sure how to invest the money. And because my profession plays head games, not quite as enjoyable to listen to as Farner, but because the financial services industry and the journalists who cover us and write about what you should do, it can be so incredibly confusing. I'm not surprised at all that most people have no clue how to invest. I think we'll spend a show on how to choose an advisor. Some of you may not feel you need one, but it never hurts to do a double check. 36%, mostly confident. This is of the people who have retirement savings and investments to manage. 33%, slightly. 15%, not at all confident about making decisions on their accounts. Interesting. I'm glad the Fed does these surveys. Here's a biggie for all of us up until Medicare, and even then. Most people still can't afford health care costs. Well, if you think about it, an emergency fund that can't go over $400, anybody know of a health care plan currently available with a deductible lower than $400? Average deductibles now, I think, are starting at $3,000. Most people are closer to $5,000. Some are above that. Those aren't even called high deductible plans anymore like they used to be. You know, I don't bring all this stuff up to depress you. I bring this stuff up to say, pat yourself on the back if you're doing better than most. And if you're not, take a moment, just a moment, a few minutes, and figure out what you could do to better position yourself in the future. Is it possible, based on what you're currently making, to defer some of your spending so that you'll have something to spend in the future? Have no worries. The final song of the show is an optimistic one, and then I'll make some positive comments after that. But, you know, there are times we all need to wake up, and that's sort of the purpose of today's show. Now, whether you're currently regularly monitoring your investments and savings or not, one of the things you may discover when you go to do that is staring at all those numbers can give you double vision. Another from Farner. Now you know why I try to talk as much as possible about enjoying life, getting outside, play some golf, go for a hike, go boating, go hang out at the pool. There's lots of free things you can do outside. It's the one thing we don't actually have to pay for. So when the weather's nice, you might gain perspective by simply taking a walk. I've always thought that the insult, "Hey, buddy, take a hike," was actually originally advice. Somebody could see that somebody else needed to take a break. And the best way I take a break, other than going to B-Town Coffee, which I plan to do here shortly, is take a hike. Go walk. Get on your bicycle. Go have some fun. But think of everything we discussed on the show today long enough to make sure that you're not one of those people that doesn't have what you need when it comes to emergencies and retirement. Okay, let's move to something more optimistic with comments afterwards. It's interesting, you know, one of the lines from one of the songs I looked at had a comment about, and it may be the song I'm about to play. You know, isn't that funny? It's fun multitasking and try to look at the microphone and a piece of paper at the same time. It is from the song I'm about to play. Isn't that cool? Unfortunately, I did write it down. The headlines read, "These are the worst of times." I do believe it's true. A little more optimistically, "Some rain and some shine." This song written in 1981, it's no worse now in many ways than it was then. Human beings always have challenges, but in some ways, it's always the best of times. Here's Styx.
"Tonight's the night we'll make history. Honey, you and I. 'Cause I'll take any risk to tie back the hands of time and stay with you here tonight. I know you feel these are the worst of times. I do believe it's true. When people lock their doors and hide inside, rumor has it it's the end of paradise. But I know if the world just passed us by, baby, I know I wouldn't have the kind, no, no,
the best of times are when I'm alone with you. Some rain, some shine, we'll make this
read, "These are the worst of times. I do believe it's true.
I feel so helpless, like a boat against the tide. I wish the summer wind could bring back paradise, but I know.
Back in 1981, Styx, The Best of Times, demonstrating the challenge of finding music that is not about love and romance and using it on the show. I'm stretching the bounds because obviously A World for Two doesn't apply to all of us. I have something funny I could say, but I will resist the urge at any rate. I hope you all have a great week. And when you think of the best of times and why I would say we always live in the best of times, I want you to think about something before you beat yourself up for not having an emergency fund or proper retirement savings or whatever, not carrying adequate insurance. You decide what the issue is. It is your decision, by the way. It's your money. That's something an important consideration in choosing an advisor is that they remember whose money it is. Here's the thing. The past is the past. There's not a thing you can do to change it. You might change how you feel about the past, but it's already done. You have no power there. Now, the future, can't wait. But I got to tell you, there's no power there either. The only time you have any power is in the present, really in this very millisecond, because that millisecond I spoke of just disappeared. The only place you have power is the present, and that's why I say it is always the best of times. Have a great week. Have a great time. I look forward to interviewing a friend of mine who has written a great book next week. Until then, enjoy.